Okay, we've made it. We've made it to Friday, both in our real world, right here, right now, in our current, and in the life of Christ, at least his last week, his last Friday that he's going to be on the earth before he goes through his death and resurrection. We had talked yesterday at the end a little bit about Annas and why he was perhaps called high priest. And now we find Jesus standing before him. We're going to start reading. We're in John chapter 18 and verse 15. And I know there's been some come in the last couple of days. And I don't know if there's any more of the outlines left, but we do have some timelines if you're interested in getting a hold of one of those. John chapter 18, starting with verse 13. I think I said 15, but 13. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. And we're going to drop down to verse 19 now, if you're following in your scriptures. The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, "I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues, in the temple, and where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said." And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but if well, why do you strike me?" This is the first time that anyone of the council or anyone of the priests or anyone in Jewish authority has actually physically reached out and harmed Jesus. It's the first strike, physically. They've challenged him emotionally, they've challenged him spiritually, they've challenged him with legal questions, and now they reach out, and one of them actually smacks him across the side of the face. How many times before have they tried to get a hold of this man, and he eludes them? He goes out another way. They lose him in the crowd. They're ready to grab him, and he challenges them to the point that they're afraid to grab a hold of him. He, perhaps, on at least one occasion, it seems, would have just sort of disappeared and walked through them, maybe. It's pretty incredible that number of times that they have attempted to grab a hold of him, and now they have him, and somebody actually lays physical hands on him. And he asks, "What evil have I done? What have I done to deserve this?" He knows what's about to happen. He knows what's coming. They hope they know what's coming, but neither of them are looking at it the same way. Going back up now to verse 15, we find that Peter and another disciple are following him. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Now that Jesus was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood outside the door. Then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. Peter and the other disciple are now present. They're going to be able to be close at hand watching everything that is going on. And now he finds himself before, in just a little bit, he finds himself before Caiaphas. I'm not hitting any of this, am I? There we go. Before Caiaphas. Mark chapter 14. Mark chapter 14, verse 53 tells us that they did now at this point lead him away to Caiaphas, the high priest. And verse 54 is Mark's account of Peter following him. So now we pick up the story with verse 55. Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" But not even then did their testimony agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?" But he kept silent and answered nothing. Again the high priest asked him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Then some began to spit on him and to blindfold him and to beat him and to say to him, "Prophesy." And the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. Matthew talks about that, also adds to this, that they were spitting in his face and asking him to prophesy. "Who is it that hit you? Tell me who it was." I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about some reasons why this Jewish trial was illegal. I take these from a series of Jewish laws that are in something called the Mishnah. It was a collection of rules that were passed down by word of mouth and weren't written down till about 200 AD. So quite a time really after the death of Christ, but not too awful far. So it's possible that some of these laws were not necessarily in place during Jesus' trials. But based on what I've read and looked at, I think most of them were. Most of them were. So let's look at some of the things that made this trial before Caiaphas out of order as far as Jewish law was concerned. One of the first things I noticed was the trials were not allowed the day before a Sabbath or the day before a festival. One of the reasons is actually going to come up in just a little bit, why that was not allowed. But this was to be a day of preparation and getting ready, and they weren't allowed to have trials there. Then, the other thing is that the trials, any trials like this, were supposed to be held on the temple grounds. Where are they at right now? Does anybody remember? They're at Caiaphas' house. They're at Caiaphas' house. So not only was it supposed to be held on the temple grounds, there's no way it was supposed to be held at the home of one of the judges, or the primary judge for sure. This is, death penalty cases had to be tried during daylight hours. This is in the middle of the night. The vast majority of Jews in Jerusalem have no idea what's going on right now. They can't. They're asleep. They're not paying attention. They're resting. They're trying to get ready for the next day. And here's why, one of the reasons anyway, why it was not allowed the day before a Sabbath or a feast day. Because after judgment was passed, one day was required for reflection. So you had the trial, and once the trial reached its conclusion and a judgment was determined, they could not sentence, they could not execute the sentence or sentence them for a whole day, so that the judge had time to reflect, had time to consider the weight of the punishment and whether it fit the crime. Well, they're not about to do that either. This is very hasty. Capital cases were to start with reasons for acquittal, not reasons for conviction. Jesus is not even given a chance, really, to defend himself. Technically he is, because they ask him these questions, but the way they ask the questions, the only way he can answer them is to give them the answer they want to incriminate himself. He's not allowed, which should have been done, for him to start off with reasons, first of all, to know the charges against him, and then to start off with why he's not guilty. But they start with all the reasons why he should be convicted and the accusations. And then the accused was supposed to have a lawyer. Even in our day, we have that law. We don't demand it. You have the right to represent yourself, should you deem that important. But under their laws, the accused didn't really have that option. A lawyer was to be present to defend the person being accused of the crime. So this farce that's going on here at the high priest's house is wrong in so many ways, even according to the Jewish law, even according to their own standards of what was right. But as we see with the scribes and Pharisees, and as we talked about Caiaphas's tendencies, especially when he and Pilate started kind of working together to control this area, under certain circumstances, they're willing to kind of overlook and bypass some of the rules. And this is one of those circumstances where they're willing to do, at this point, whatever it takes. Whatever it takes to stay in control and to get rid of Christ. Okay, so back to Friday. They've examined him before Annas, the semi-high priest, if you want to think of him that way, and Caiaphas, the actual high priest. While at the end of this, Jesus receives his first beating. Now, this is important because of Roman law. The Jews almost, and I say this because just based on what I read on the Roman law, the Jews almost mess up here. Now, God's going to insist that his will be done, and we've talked about that, the providence of God, and things are going to happen as they're supposed to. But if the Roman leader, if Pilate interpreted everything the way he should. First of all, we'll talk about this in a little bit. He doesn't find any Roman reason why he should be punished. But second of all, if they bring him to Pilate in a beaten condition, obviously he's been punished already. Pilate really has he has two options. There's either if the Jews are going to bring a charge against him, then there can be no punishment until he gets to the Roman trial. If a punishment has already been given by the Jews, Pilate, by Roman law, can't hand out any other punishment. He's been punished. That's it. They took it into their own hands. They delivered the punishment. He can still be found guilty of something under Roman law, but technically he can't be punished because the Jews have already done that. And Pilate supersedes all that too. He just lets it go. All right. During this time, kind of at the same time all of this is going on, we have the three denials of Peter. Matthew chapter 26, verses 69 through 75. This one I'm not going to read, but we know that three times throughout this evening, they're probably spaced out a little bit. We don't know the exact, I don't think, chronology of when each one occurred over the course of the evening. We can do a little speculating. But at some point over the course of these two times before the Jewish leadership, Peter denies the Lord the three times. Now the part I want to bring out is in Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, Luke records something that the others don't record in verse 61. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. This is after the third denial and after the rooster crows. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So Peter went out and wept bitterly. This is one of those times that I've often wondered what all was in that look. You know, you can do something and somebody will look at you in a certain way and you know immediately what they're thinking. I know this because I can remember my parents looking at me in certain ways. I can remember teachers looking at me in certain ways. And it's just, we have this sense of what's happening. And I've often wondered what was mixed with this look that Jesus gave to Peter. There was probably a little bit of disappointment, a little bit of pain because he's been beaten by this time. I've often wondered if maybe there was a little bit of, I told you so. Do you believe me now, Peter? Because it says Peter now remembers as soon as the look happens. And how does he react to that in the next verse? He goes out and weeps bitterly. He knows what he's done. This is a sign of repentance, isn't it? He is crushed by this because he was so sure. Remember? He was so sure that that would never happen. And yet here he is, right where Jesus said he would be. I also want to point out that when John talks about this time period, he points out that Peter at one point was warming himself around a fire. You remember that? And he points out that also in that same area, warming themselves around that fire, were servants and officials of the Sanhedrin. So some of this happens right where the very people that are trying to kill Jesus are gathered. It's very close. So there's no doubt in my mind that he could have seen Jesus quite clearly and the things that were going on. Okay. Luke chapter 22. Let's see. Starting with verse 66. This is a pivotal point. As soon as it was day, so now we have another time stamp, right? It is after daybreak on Friday. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go." Jesus just points out to him, you know what? It's not going to matter what I say. Because if I tell you the truth, I've told you before and you don't believe me. It's not going to change anything. And if I don't answer you, if I ask you questions about who I am, you're not going to admit to it. It's almost as if Jesus is saying, can we just move this along? Why are we keeping to do this? Back and forth, back and forth. So he says in verse 69, "Hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God." And they pick up on this. They ask, "Are you then the Son of God?" And Jesus says, "You rightly say that I am." "What further testimony do we need?" they said, "for we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth." From his own mouth. And they formally condemn him. They pass a judgment, and this is a pivotal point because this is the point at which the Sanhedrin and the chief priests believe they finally caught him. They finally caught him. It's also important because right after this happens, oops, I didn't get that one. In Matthew chapter 27, starting with verse 11, verse 3. Got ahead of myself. "Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned." You notice what Judas is waiting around to find out? It has occurred to me that Judas has been with him the whole time, just like Peter and the others. He's seen him accused of things by the Jewish leadership and walked away. He's seen him challenged by the Jewish leadership and talked his way out of it, or walked his way out of it, or gotten out of it, just like everybody else had seen him do. And it occurred to me, perhaps Judas, when he agreed to betray him, was not really that interested in betraying Christ. He was interested in the 40 pieces of silver. So he was greedy. This is easy money. I'm going to agree to betray Christ. I'm going to get my 40 pieces of silver, and then Christ is going to escape from them, and everything's going to be fine. And it seems like when he realizes that Jesus has been condemned, when he is not going anywhere, and he probably remembers some of the things Jesus said about his impending death, and things are starting to click. And now he's beside himself. He doesn't know what to do. Peter, when he got in a position where he was sorry about something he'd done to the Lord, he went out and wept bitterly. He repented. Judas doesn't seem to have that same bent, because he has a pouch full of money that is representative to him. It's a physical existence of what he's just done. And it's hurting him. It's heavy. It's a heavy weight in more ways than one. So when he, in verse 3, saw that he had been condemned, was remorseful, brought back the 30 pieces of 30, I keep saying 40, I think, 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." Now, it's like he's asking them for forgiveness. And they say, what is that to us? You see to it. Then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went out and hanged himself. This is different than Peter, isn't it? See, this is a great connection. We have a whole lesson on this, but this is a great thing to think about. When we make mistakes, when we sin, when we do something wrong, these are the two different ways that we can react. We can be sorry for it to the point that we change, and it bothers us to the point that we never do that again, just like Peter. Or it can bother us, but we can really try to fix it ourselves somehow, and it's never going to be successful. And spiritually, that reaction kills us, destroys us. So when we mess up, we have those two choices too, don't we? We have to decide, are we going to be more like Peter, or are we going to be more like Judas? And we know that the chief priests, they feel like they can't take the money. All of a sudden, the rules apply. Do you notice that? All of a sudden, the rules apply. They weren't supposed to use this money to buy false testimony or betrayal or anything in the first place, but that didn't matter. They weren't supposed to have the trials the way they had them, but that didn't matter. The accusations they lay to him are false, but that doesn't matter. But all of a sudden, this money shows back up at the treasury. Well, we can't take that. All of a sudden, they're back in their religious, pious mode. And now Jesus is taken before Pilate. We'll stick around in Matthew, still in chapter 27, and we'll pick it up with verse 11. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he answered him not one word, so that the governor marveled greatly. What do you suppose normally happened when somebody's standing before Pilate and being accused of all kinds of things by people? How does the accused probably normally react to that? Defending himself. "No, I didn't do this. Let me get my witnesses. Let's do this." But Jesus seems ambivalent. He's just standing there, not really seeming to want to participate. In Luke chapter 23, we see some of the charges that they are laying at Pilate. Now, I think this is pretty important in as far as the things that are happening with the Roman court. Luke chapter 23. And it's in verses 2 through 7. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nation." That's the first charge they lay at him. He's causing problems for the empire. They're not talking about the Jewish nation, because Pilate really could care less about that. He's causing problems among the Romans. Then the second charge, they say, he's forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar. We already looked at it. It hasn't been that long when he took the coinage and said, whose symbol is it on there? Whose image? And give to Caesar what's Caesar's. Pay your taxes, he said. And then the third charge, he claims himself, he himself is Christ, a king. Now he's already said that, right, to Pilate? He admitted to that one. John, we won't turn there, but in John's account of this, John says that one of the things Pilate said to them was, judge him according to your own law. Now, if you go back to day one and can remember some of the things we talked about Pilate, you remember that he had been given specific orders by Tiberius, do not interfere with the laws of the Jews. Let them do their own thing unless it's causing an uproar. The charges they find him guilty of, that the chief priests can get the backing of the Jewish leaders in the Sanhedrin, when they come before Pilate, that's never even mentioned, is it? It's never brought up, because Pilate could care less about that. And Pilate senses that they're doing this out of envy, we're told. And so instead, he says, you just judge him according to your own law. And he'd already been beaten, so Pilate had every right to just walk away. But he doesn't do it, because they keep insisting. They're so persistent. Until it is brought up that he is from Galilee. When that happens, Pilate sees his out, right? Pilate sees a chance to get out from under all of this. He's going to be able to just turn it over to somebody else and let them deal with it. So in Luke chapter 23, we find Jesus in front of Herod. And this is a completely different situation. All right? This is pretty interesting. Verse 8. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he desired to be for a long time to see him, because he had heard so many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but he answered nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. Why would it be that Jesus seems willing to, at some level, and he does several times, interact with Pilate, but he doesn't interact a bit with Herod? I think one reason is that Herod is not really interested in anything that's going on other than curiosity. He just wants to see if Jesus will do something cool. And Jesus isn't about to do that right now. That's not the point that he's there for. Jesus didn't walk around doing miracles just because he felt like it. He did them to prove who he was, to give proof of his kingship, his godship, his Messiah. That's why he did the miracles. Herod doesn't care any about that at all. Plus, Herod can't do anything. Herod can't pass judgment for sentencing for death any more than Caiaphas can under the Roman law. Herod could try somebody and find them guilty or innocent and then turn them over to the Roman authorities for sentencing, but he couldn't actually do much. And so Jesus just wants nothing to do with him. So as a result, he sends him back to Pilate. Now at first glance, you would think that Pilate would be a little irritated with this. But we're told there that Pilate and Herod became friends after that day. And I said on the first day, I pointed out that that was probably because Herod Antipas, Herod sided with Rome and not with the Jews, because Herod could have said, he's done nothing wrong, let him go. And there would be no appeal to Pilate for that. It would be over. But Herod just sends him back to Pilate. And Pilate sees that as quite a political maneuver. He kind of appreciates him for it a little bit. It's kind of odd, I know. Most of us are not politically wired that way. But Pilate and Herod both definitely were. So he comes back before Pilate for a second go. This second trial is pretty involved. And I'm hoping we have some time, because we're going to do some jumping around to see some of the things that happen. We're going to start out in Luke chapter 23 and verse 13. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." And we're going to talk about that chastisement here in just a little bit, Lord willing. So now jump over to Matthew chapter 27. Starting with verse 15. "Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, 'Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?' For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy." See, Pilate knows exactly what's going on. Verse 19. "While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, 'Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him.' But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus." I saw a t-shirt one time that said, "Never underestimate a group of people and the idiocy that they can produce." That the mob mentality can be pretty irrational sometimes. And so here we go, with they're now able to stir up the mob because of these things, to the point that they were praising Jesus and lauding him as King and Messiah and hanging on his every word, and the priests and high priests, the chief priests, the Pharisees, the leaders of the Jews were all afraid of the people because they took him to be a prophet. And now they have convinced those same people, at least many of them, those same people they have convinced to ask for a murderer, an insolent man, to be released and let out into the public, and let's get rid of this miracle-working, prophesying, teaching Jesus. It's not logical, but it's that mob mentality. Verse 21, "The governor answered and said to them, 'Which of the two do you want me to release to you?' They said, 'Barabbas.' Pilate said to them, 'What then shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?' They all said to him, 'Let him be crucified.'" That's the first time that's come up. "Then the governor said, 'Why, what evil has he done?' But they cried out all the more, saying, 'Let him be crucified.'" Let's go back to the book of Luke again and pick up the story as Luke's recording it, the account, sorry, as Luke is recording it, in Luke 23, starting with verse 20. "Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them, and they shouted to him, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' Then he said to them the third time." Pilate doesn't give up very easy. What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified, and the voices of these men and the chief priests prevailed. Back to Matthew 27 and verse 24. "When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising, He took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. And all the people answered and said, His blood be on us and our children. Then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. The soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. When they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! Then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about this scourging. The Romans had three levels of scourging. From the least to the worst, they are fustigation, flagella, and verberatio. If I'm saying some of those a little differently than you're used to hearing them, sorry. Least to greatest. When Pilate says several times, I will chastise him and release him, he's talking about the lesser of these three levels. It was still a whipping, but was not nearly as long and was not nearly as intense and was not nearly as violent. It was meant to just make a point and let the person go. But they don't want that. And so Pilate sentences him to crucifixion, which meant that he was going to get a verberatio, the worst. It's where we get the word vibrate. This was going to be a very serious, very hard, bone-rattling, deep beating. Verberatio was required before crucifixion. It was done by a four-member squad. These men, just like in our military today, we have squads of men that they specialize in a certain thing. That's what they do. And this group over here specializes in this, and that group specializes in that, and they focus on that all the time. This squad, there was one of these squads present everywhere there was a Roman center of law, a garrison. And their job was to beat prisoners. That's all they did. They got up in the morning, they ate their breakfast, and they practiced. Or they went about beating the next prisoner that deserved it. And these four members had very specific tasks. The leader of the group was called the exactor mortis. Okay, the exactor mortis. He was in charge. Everything that happened, happened under his supervision. And it was his job to make sure that the sentence was carried out to the judge's orders. There was another individual, and I couldn't find his technical legal name at the time. I'm going to call him the confiner. He was the one that was supposed to make sure that the prisoner stayed fast. What they would do, there was a within the Roman garrison, there was a courtyard that was open to the public around the edge somewhere. And it was big enough that several prisoners could be in there at the same time if necessary, and large crowds could gather around the outside, and there was a short wall around the whole thing to kind of keep them separated from the prisoners. But they could still see. And within this area, there were several posts, depending on how big the area was. There would be posts that were sunk down into the ground so that they stuck up out of the ground anywhere, depending on what you read, anywhere from 2.5 feet to 8 feet. I saw all different measurements, so I don't know exactly how tall they were. But what would happen is on the top, there was a ring, a metal ring affixed to the top of the post. The prisoner's hands would be bound together like this. And then around that lashing, they would hook it into the ring and hold the prisoner's arms up like this. Depending on the size of the post, they could either be standing next to the post or kneeling next to the post. And then the prisoner's legs around the ankles, usually, or if they were kneeling, right around the base of the knee, would then be also lashed to the post. This was to keep the prisoner from being able to move or turn or wiggle. And this person had two jobs. Job number one was he had to make sure that in the process of the beating, the prisoner is going to be moving and wiggling and running around as much as he can. And if he got loose a little bit, he had to tighten things up. That was job number one. Job number two is he was there in case one of the two people doing the actual whipping got tired. And then he would take over for them and let them rest for just a bit. And that leads us to the other two people that were standing by, and they were the scourgers. They each would have a whip, and they each had the same job, and they would stand on one side and one on the other. That was one method of doing it. One on one side, one on the other. And then they would just whip the person back and forth and back and forth. The whips they used were varied. This is just one example. I didn't want to take time and show all the different examples of the ones that I found. But they all had similar traits. They had some sort of an either leather or wooden handle, and then several flagellum that would come out for the whips. They would use various instruments during the course of the beating. They wouldn't use the same whip the whole time sometimes. Sometimes they would start off with a stick, or sometimes they would start off with just simple leather straps. But at some point, they had other instruments. If you've done any research into Roman society at the time of Christ at all, you'll recognize how violent the society was. The gladiator matches, all the stuff that was going on. And these people they enjoyed violence, many of them. I won't say all of them, because that's too inclusive for an entire society. But many of them did. And these men, it was their job to not only punish, but also to entertain the people standing by watching and themselves, and to make the beating so severe that it was seen as a form of preventative medicine, so that nobody else would want to do that and get in that position. So because of that, they would often tie things. They had whips that would have things tied into various places along the length of the whip. They would use pieces of bone, pieces of pottery, different things that they would put in there. But they've also found these over there. These are small metal rings that are, you can see, completely arranged with spikes. These were one of the things that, toward the end of the whipping, they would add in to the whip, or have whips ready that they were attached already. This just gives you a sense of about how big they are. They really aren't that big. Okay? Their purpose was this. They had gotten to the point of perfecting these beatings, that they knew with each whip how to wield that whip to inflict the most pain and the most damage. They would take these whips, and as they swung the whip would hit the back of the person, or the back of the legs, or the arms, or wherever it was that they were hitting at the moment, and the whip would wrap around, and they had it so that they could time it and then pull. Just as those spikes or the bones or whatever they had attached to the whips met the flesh. What this did was create large gashes in the skin, sometimes clear down through into the muscle. They'd also placed a crown of thorns on him. Now, we don't know exactly what that crown of thorns looked like or what it was made of. And there's probably lots of other plants over there that are thorny, but these are three thorny vines that I found that were possibilities. But I just wanted us to get a sense of what perhaps Jesus had on the top of his head during this, and had the rod smacked down on top of it. Eusebius was a historian of the day, and he said this about the whippings. Bystanders were struck with amazement when they saw them lacerated with scourges, even to the innermost veins and arteries, so that the hidden inward parts of the body, both their bowels and their members, were exposed to view. Scourging was before crucifixion. They were not allowed to have the prisoner die. But if a further punishment wasn't awaiting, and the worst whipping was prescribed, if the person died while being whipped, oh well. And there were lots of accounts. That was one quote I found, but there were lots of accounts of historians that described the horror. If we had been there and seen this, if we were in the crowd watching this occur, I don't know if I could have stood there and watched. It would have been ghastly. Absolutely horrible. I don't know. Most of us probably would have had to turn away. So he receives this whipping, this scourging. Pilate gives in. I guess I didn't do those. Pilate gives in. He's sentenced to death. And then he is led out to Calvary. Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23, starting with verse 26. Now as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country. And on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. And a great multitude of the people followed him, and women who also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, Blessed are the barren wombs that never bore, and the breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say, To the mountains fall on us, and to the hills cover us. For if they do these things in the greenwood, what will be done in the dry? Jesus still has, with this beating, with the pain, with what is going on, he still has the presence of mind to teach and to prophesy and to interact with the believers and with the people around him. It's just absolutely incredible. So Jesus is crucified. Crucified around 9 a.m. We have to remember that the timekeeping could go either way, quite a bit of time. And dies about 3 a.m. Luke records that there was darkness from 12 to 3. I want to go through several scriptures. I think we will have time to do this. I want to go through several scriptures that describe some of the things that happened while Jesus was on the cross. We're going to start in Mark chapter 15. Verse 22. And they brought him to the place, Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. Then they gave him wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he did not take it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments, casting lots for them, to determine what every man should take. Now it was the third hour, and they crucified him, and the inscription of his accusation was written above, The King of the Jews. This initial drink that he's offered, my understanding is that this quite possibly was a drink that was meant to slightly sedate the individual. Not put them out, but just relax them for the process of actually nailing them to the equipment so that they didn't squirm as much and they could be more accurate. I know that sounds horrible, but that's what happened. Most people are not going to just lay there while you drive a spike through their arm. It's just not going to happen. John chapter 19, starting with verse 19. Now Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And many of the Jews read this title, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Therefore the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, Do not write the King of the Jews, but he said, I am the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, What I have written, I have written. This is Pilate's last chance to get a dig in on Christ. Or on the Jews, sorry. To get a dig in on the Jews. They had politically coerced him into this event. He really didn't have a lot of choice. They told him, if you don't do this, you're not a friend of Caesar. We'll report you. And if you remember from the first day I talked about, it's only about 3 years or so later that they do report something that he did that they challenged was against the empire, and he was removed from his position and never heard from again. So Pilate has a real fear of what will happen if Caesar gets upset, if Tiberius gets angry. And so this is his last chance to take a shot at the Jews. They don't want it to say he is the King of the Jews, because that condemns them. They want to say he said, an accusation, but Pilate refuses. Back to the book of Luke, chapter 23, verse 34. Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And they divided his garments and cast lots. Again, Jesus is continually aware of everything that's going on. That's probably why he refused that first drink. He did not want to be numbed. Does Jesus have the power to stop this? Does he have the power to end all of this right now? With a thought, right? By just thinking, he can't lose who he is in this process. He can't lose control. So he wants to do everything in his power to maintain control. Matthew chapter 27, starting with verse 39. And those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise, the chief priests also, mocking with the scribes and elders, said, He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver him now if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. Are you really the Son of God? Has God left you alone? These are very related to the questions that John was answering about why is there evil in the world, isn't it? That's the same thing they're doing. If there really is a God that is on your side, why are bad things happening to you right now? Has he turned his back? Luke chapter 23. Starting with verse 39. Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, If you are the Christ, save yourselves and us. That's a selfish statement, isn't it? Save yourself and us. But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, Do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. I don't think that this criminal understood the concept of bring me into your kingdom. He probably was like everyone else, expecting that the Messiah would set up an earthly place. Wow, my time is up. I'm going to give you these in order so you can look these up if you want to see what I think in order is the rest of the happenings that happened on the cross. John chapter 19, verses 25 through 27. And then Luke chapter 23, verses 44 and 45. Then Mark chapter 15, verses 34 through 36. Then John chapter 19, verse 30. Then Luke chapter 23, verse 46. Matthew chapter 27, verses 51 through 56. And John chapter 19, verses 31 through 37. And if you want to see me later and get those, if you didn't quite get those, I'll give those to you. Really quickly, let's look at this a second. The cross had two parts. The Romans referred to the cross beam as the patibulum. This was a plank of unfinished wood that was about 6 feet long and weighed anywhere from 50 to 75 pounds. Heavy, long, splintery, painful on the back of a person that had just been lacerated the way Jesus had been treated. The exactor mortis on the way would lead the parade with the sign holding up the charges. He's still in charge. Jesus, of course, we know, is unable to carry this beam. And if he dies before reaching the cross, the exactor mortis is going to be blamed for it. His job is to make sure, if he dies 10 seconds after being nailed to the cross and lifted up, that's fine. But he's got to make it to the cross. So Simon is forced to carry it the rest of the way. Spikes are driven. We see the pictures, right, of it going through the hand. I think we all understand this. That's not practical. That's not the way it's described in the histories of what would have happened. The spikes were put in where the radius and the ulna meet the metacarpals. Here's some examples of some of the spikes types of spikes they believe were used. They look huge here, but they're only about 4 inches long for the hands and about 7 inches long for the feet, and not very thick. And usually there would be a piece of wood that was used as a washer to keep the victim from being able to struggle and pull free from the spikes. Then there's the staticulum, the upright post, about 8 feet tall with a notch in the top, and they would raise with posts up onto there and set it back in the notch. And once they did that, the victim's weight would hold it there. It wouldn't go anywhere. And then when they were done, all they had to do was reverse the process. Spikes were then driven through the feet or ankles. If the victim was to suffer for days, sometimes it was said, this person needs to be on the cross as long as possible. They would provide a little seat about halfway up to prolong the agony. But Jesus is not going to have a seat because the Sabbath is tomorrow. There were also three different ways to secure the feet. One way was to have a step out in front and put the feet on top of that. That was for elongated crucifixions. Another way was to put the feet on either side of the upright post and nail them in sideways. That was for victims that were supposed to last a while, but it wasn't supposed to be an extended torture. If they wanted them to die quickly, they bent the legs and flattened the feet down against the cross and then nailed them through the feet or ankles there. Because that put tremendous strain on the lower body and the legs and made it more difficult. If your feet are down like this, how easy is it to extend your knees and stand up to get a breath? You can't. So It made the suffering go much faster and the death occur much sooner. Jesus is buried just before sundown. We're almost done. And the next day, the tomb is sealed, guarded in the early morning. And then on Saturday evening after sundown, after the Sabbath is over, the women go and buy spices so they can come to the tomb the next day. It's not fun to think about, is it? But that's what happened to our Lord. That's what happened.